Chapter 19. Ms. Emma Whitestone chose to spend the night. She rose early, found the mouthwash, and gargled loud enough to wake me up. She showered, used my hairdryer, finger-combed her hair, found a lipstick and some eye stuff in her bag, which she applied in front of my dresser mirror while standing in the altogether. As she pulled her panties on, she stepped into her sandals, then slipped her dress on over her head. 4 seconds. She was a sort of low-maintenance woman who didn't require a lot of life support systems for an overnighter. I'm not used to women being ready before me, so I had to rush through my shower. I slipped on my tightest jeans along with a white tennis shirt and my Docksiders. I left the 38 locked in my dresser. At Ms. Whitestone's suggestion, we drove to the Kachaug Diner, a real 1930s icon. The place was packed with farmers, deliverymen, local merchants, a few turistos, truck drivers, and maybe one other couple who were getting to know one another over breakfast and after sex. We sat in a small booth, and I commented, "Won't people gossip if they see you in the same clothes you wore yesterday?" They stopped gossiping about me years ago. How about my reputation? Your reputation, John, can only be enhanced by your being with me. We were a bit tart this morning. She ordered a huge breakfast of sausage, eggs, home fries, and toast, commenting that she hadn't had dinner last night. I reminded her, "You drank your dinner." I offered to go for pizza. Pizza is not good for you. What you just ordered is not good for you. I'll skip lunch. How about dinner? Sure. I was going to ask. Good. Pick me up at 6 at the florist. Okay. I looked around and spotted 2 uniformed Southold cops, but no Max in sight. The food came and we ate. I love other people's cooking. Emma asked me, "Why were you so interested in Captain Kidd?" "Who?" "Oh, the pirates." "Well, it's fascinating. I mean that he was right here on the North Fork." I sort of remember that now. From when I was a kid. No pun intended. She looked at me and said, "You were all fired up last night." After my initial outburst last night, which I'd regretted, I had tried to play it cooler, as I said. But Ms. Whitestone was still curious about my curiosity. I said to her, "If I found that treasure, I'd share it with you."
"That's very sweet,"
I said, as nonchalantly as possible. "I'd like to go back to the Historical Society house. How about this afternoon?"
"Why?"
"I need to buy my mother something in the gift shop."
"If you join the society, I'll give you a discount."
"Okay. Why don't I pick you up at, say, 4?
She shrugged. "Okay."
I regarded her across the table. Sunlight fell on her face. Sometimes the morning after, and I really hate to say this, but sometimes you wonder what the hell you were thinking the night before, or worse, you wonder if you have a grudge against your dick. But this morning, I had a good feeling. I liked Emma Whitestone. I liked the way she packed down 2 fried eggs, 4 sausages, a heap of home fries, buttered toast, juice, and tea with cream. She glanced at the clock behind the counter, and I realized she didn't even wear a watch. This lady was something of a free spirit, and at the same time was president and archivist of the Peconic Historical Society. It was a nice contrast, I thought. A lot of people smiled at her and said hello, and I could see she was well-liked. That's always a good sign. If it sounds like I was falling in love for the second time that week, that might be true. However, I wondered about Emma Whitestone's judgment in men, specifically Frederick Tobin, and perhaps me as well. Possibly she was not judgmental regarding men or people in general. Maybe she liked all men. Certainly, Frederick and I couldn't have been more opposite.
Her attraction to Frederick Tobin, I suppose, was probably the bulge in the hip pocket of his pants, whereas with me, it was certainly the bulge in the front of my pants. In any case, we chatted a while, and I was determined to stay away from the subject of pirates or Captain Kidd until the afternoon. Eventually, however, my curiosity got the better of me. A long shot popped into my head, and I borrowed a pencil from the waitress and wrote 44106818 on a napkin. I turned the napkin around and said, "If I played these lottery numbers, would I be a winner?" She smiled between bites of toast. "Jackpot," she said. "Where'd you get those numbers?" "Something I read." "What do they mean?" She looked around and lowered her voice. She said, "Well, when Captain Kidd was held in a Boston jail, charged with piracy, he smuggled a note to his wife Sarah, and on the bottom of the note were those numbers." "And?" "And everyone has been trying to figure it out for the last 300 years. "What do you think they mean?" "The most obvious answer is that these numbers relate to his buried treasure." "You don't think it was the number on his dry cleaning slip?"
"Are we being silly again?"
"Just kidding." "Get it? Kidding?" She rolled her eyes. In truth, it was a bit early for my humor. She said, "I don't want to discuss this here. The last wave of kid mania hit here in the 1940s, and I don't want to be accused of starting another mass treasure hunt." "Okay." She asked me, "Do you have any children?"
"Probably."
"Be serious." "No, I don't have any children." "How about you?"
"No children. But I'd like to."
And so forth. After a while, I returned to the subject of numbers and in a whisper asked her, "Could those numbers be map coordinates?" She clearly didn't want to discuss this, but replied, "That's the obvious thing. 8-digit map coordinates, minutes and seconds. Those coordinates are actually somewhere around Deer Isle in Maine." She leaned across the table and continued, "Kidd's movements when he sailed back to the New York area in 1699 are pretty well documented day by day by reliable witnesses, so any visit to Deer Isle to bury treasure was unlikely." She added, "However, there's another legend surrounding Deer Isle. Supposedly, John Jacob Astor did find Kidd's or some other pirate's treasure on Deer Isle, and that was the start of the Astor fortune." She sipped her tea and said, "There are dozens of books, plays, ballads, rumors, legends, and myths surrounding Captain William Kidd's buried treasure. 99% of them are just that. Myth." "Okay, but aren't those numbers that Kidd wrote to his wife solid evidence of something?"
"Yes, they mean something. Yet even if they are map coordinates, navigation in those days was too primitive to pinpoint a spot on the ground with any accuracy, especially longitude. An 8-digit coordinate of minutes and seconds can be hundreds of yards off using the methods available in 1699. Even today, with a satellite navigation device, you can be off by 10 or 20 feet. If you're digging for treasure and you're off by even 20 feet, you could be digging a lot of holes. I think the theory of grid coordinates has been put aside in favor of other theories."
"Such as?" She drew an exasperated breath, glanced around, and said, "Well, here." She took the pencil and napkin and gave each number its corresponding letter in the alphabet and came up with DDAOFHAH. She said, "I think the last three letters are the key."
"HAH?"
"Right. Ha, ha, ha. Get it? Ha, ha." I studied the letters, frontwards and backwards, then turned the paper upside down and said, "Was Kidd dyslexic?" She laughed. "It's no use, John. Better brains than mine and yours have been trying to decipher that for 300 years. For all anyone knows, it's a meaningless number. A joke. Ha, ha, ha. But why? I mean,
Kid was in jail, charged with a hanging offense. Well, okay, it's not meaningless and it's not a joke. But it only made sense to Kid and to his wife. She was able to visit him in jail a few times. They spoke. They were devoted to each other. He may have given her half a clue verbally, or another clue in a letter that's since been lost. This was interesting. Like the kind of thing I do, except this clue was 300 years old. I asked her, any more theories? Well, the prevailing theory is that these numbers represent paces, which is the traditional method of pirates recording the location of their buried treasure. Paces? Yes. Paces from where? That's what Mrs. William Kidd knew, and you don't. Oh. I looked at the numbers. That's a lot of paces. Again, you have to know the personal code. It could mean, she looked at the napkin, 44 paces in a direction of 10 degrees and 68 paces in a direction of 18 degrees, or vice versa. Or read it backwards. Who knows? It doesn't matter if you don't know the starting point. Do you think the treasure is buried under one of those oak trees? Captain Kidd's trees? I don't know. She added, either the treasure has been found and the person who found it didn't advertise it to the world, or there was never any treasure, or it's still buried and will stay buried forever. What do you think? I think I should go open my shop. She crumpled the napkin and stuffed it in my shirt pocket. I paid the bill and we left. The diner was 5 minutes from the Peconic Historical Society where Emma had left her van. I pulled into the lot and she gave me a quick peck on the cheek, like we were more than just lovers. She said, see you at 4. Whitestone Florist, Main Road, Mattituck. She got out, hopped into her van, honked, waved, and pulled away. I sat in my Jeep a while, listening to the local news. I would have gotten on the road, but I didn't know where to go. In truth, I'd exhausted most of my leads, and I didn't have an office where I could go and shuffle papers. I wasn't going to get any calls from witnesses, forensics, and so forth. Very few people even knew where to send me an anonymous tip. In short, I felt like a private detective, though I wasn't even licensed to do that. All things considered, however, I'd made some startling discoveries since meeting Emma Whitestone. If I had any doubts about why the Gordons had been murdered, that number, 44106818, which was in their chart book, should put the doubts to rest. On the other hand, even if it were true that Tom and Judy Gordon were treasure hunters, and I had no doubt they were based on all the evidence, it didn't necessarily follow that treasure hunting was what got them killed. What was the provable connection between their archaeological digs on Plum Island and the bullets through their heads on their back deck? I called my answering machine. Two messages. One from Max, asking where to mail my $1 check, and another call from my boss, Detective Lieutenant Wolf, again strongly urging me to call his office and indicating that I was in deep doo-doo and sinking fast. I put the car in gear and drove. Sometimes it's good to just drive. On the radio, the news guy said, an update on the double homicide of two Plum Island scientists in Nassau Point. The Southold Town Police and the Suffolk County Police have issued a joint statement. The news guy, it sounded like Don from Tuesday morning, read the statement verbatim. Jeez. If we could get the network hotshots in the city to read our press releases without comment, we'd be in public relations heaven. The joint statement was a hot air balloon with no one in the gondola except two dead bodies. The statement stressed the theft of Ebola vaccine as a motive. A separate statement from the FBI said that they didn't know if the perpetrators were foreign or domestic, but they were pursuing some good leads. The World Health Organization expressed concern over the theft of this vital and important vaccine that was desperately needed in many third world countries, and so forth. The thing that really pissed me off was that the official version of what happened had the effect of branding Tom and Judy as cynical, heartless thieves. First, they stole their employer's time and resources. Then, when they secretly developed a vaccine, they stole the formula and presumably some samples and intended to sell it for a huge profit. Meanwhile, people in Africa were dying by the thousands of this horrible disease. I could picture Nash, Foster, the four suit guys I'd seen coming off the ferry, and a bunch of White House and Pentagon spin control types burning up the phone lines between Plum Island and D.C. As soon as everyone learned that the Gordons were involved with genetically altered vaccines, then the perfect cover story presented itself to these geniuses. To be fair, they wanted to avoid panic about plague, but I'd bet my potential three-quarter lifetime disability pension that not one person in Washington considered the Gordons' reputations or their families when they concocted the story, branding them as thieves. The irony, if there was an irony here, was that Foster, Nash, and the government were undoubtedly still convinced that the Gordons stole one or more biological warfare diseases. The Washington insiders, from the president on down through the chain of command, were still sleeping with biocontainment suits over their jammies. Good. Screw them. I stopped at a deli in Kachaug and bought a container of coffee and a bunch of newspapers. The New York Times, The Post, The Daily News, and Long Island's Newsday. In all four papers, the Gordon story had been relegated to a few inches on the inside pages. Even Newsday didn't give the local murder much attention. I'm sure a lot of people in Washington were happy that the story was fading. And so was I. It gave me as much of a free hand as it gave them. And while Foster, Nash, and company were looking for foreign agents and terrorists, I'd followed my hunch and gone with my feelings about Tom and Judy Gordon. I was happy and not too surprised to discover that what I'd thought all along was true. This was not about biological warfare, or about narcotics, or anything illegal. Well, not too illegal. Anyway, I still didn't know who murdered them. Equally important, I knew they were not criminals, and I intended to give them their reputations back. I finished the coffee, threw the newspapers in the back seat, and got on the road. I drove up to the Soundview, a 1950s waterfront motel. I went into the office and inquired after Messrs. Foster and Nash. The young man behind the desk said the gentleman I was describing had both checked out already. I drove around. I hesitate to say aimlessly, but if you don't know where you're going or why, you're either a government employee or you're aimless. Anyway, I decided to drive to Orient Point. It was another nice day, a bit cooler and breezier, but pleasant. I drove to the Plum Island ferry station. I wanted to check out the cars in the lot, see if there was any unusual activity, and maybe see if I ran into anyone interesting. When I pulled into the facility and approached the gate, a Plum Island security guard stepped into my path and held up his hand. Softy that I am, I didn't run him over. He came around to my window and asked me, "Can I help you, sir?" I held up my shield case and said, "I'm working with the FBI on the Gordon case." He studied the shield and ID closely, and I watched his face. Clearly, I was on this man's short list of saboteurs, spies, and perverts, and he wasn't very cool about it. He stared at me a moment, cleared his throat, and said, "Sir, if you'll pull over here, I'll get you a pass." "Okay." I pulled to the side. I hadn't expected a security guy at the gate, though I should have. The guy went into the brick building, and I continued on into the parking lot. I have a problem with authority. The first thing I noticed was that there were two military Humvees parked at the ferry slip. I could see two uniformed men in each Humvee, and as I got closer, I was able to identify them and the Humvees as Marine Corps. I hadn't seen a single military vehicle on Plum Island Tuesday morning, but the world had changed since then. I also spotted a big black Caprice that could have been the one I'd seen Tuesday with the four suit guys in it. I noted the license plate number. Then, riding around through the 100 or so parked cars, I saw a white Ford Taurus with rental plates, and I was pretty certain this could be the car that Nash and Foster drove. Big doings at Plum Island today. Neither ferry was in the slip or on the horizon, and except for the Marines waiting to drive their Humvees onto an arriving ferry, there was no one around. Except when I looked in my side-view mirror, I saw four. Count 'em. Four blue uniformed security guards running toward me, waving and hollering. Obviously, I'd misunderstood the gate guard. Oh, dear. I drove my vehicle toward the four guards. I could hear them now yelling, "Stop! Stop!" Fortunately, they weren't going for their guns. I wanted the report to Messrs. Foster and Nash to be entertaining, so I drove in circles around the four guards, waving back at them and yelling to them, "Stop! Stop!" I did a couple of figure eights, then before anyone closed the steel gate or got crazy with the guns, I drove toward the exit. I cut hard left onto Main Road and hit the gas, heading back west. No one fired. That's why I love this country. Within 2 minutes, I was on the narrow strip of land that connects Orient to East Marion. The sound was to my right, the bay to my left, and lots of birds were in between. Atlantic Coastal Flyway. You learn something new every day. Suddenly, this big white gull came in at me from 12 o'clock high. It was a beautifully timed and executed flight, a long, steep dive followed by a slight flare-out which resulted in a more shallow dive, then a pull-out and climb. Then, with perfect timing, he let loose his payload, which splattered purple and green across my windshield. It was that kind of day. I hit the windshield wipers, but the washer reservoir was empty, and I had this stuff smeared across my field of vision. Yuck, yuck. I pulled over. Damn. Ever resourceful, I got my expensive bottle of Tobin Merlot out of the back seat, and got my trusty Swiss Army knife with the corkscrew from the glove compartment. I opened the wine and poured some of the Merlot over the windshield as the wipers swept back and forth. I drank a little of the wine. Not bad. I poured more on the windshield, then drank some more. A guy in a passing car honked and gave me a wave. Fortunately, the bomb load was made up of pretty much what the wine was made of, and the windshield was reasonably clean. Except for a purple film. I finished the bottle and threw it in the back seat. On my way again. I thought about Emma Whitestone. I'm the kind of guy who always sends flowers the next day. However, sending flowers to a florist might be redundant. For all I knew, my FTD order would go through her. She'd make up the bouquet and hand it to herself. Enough silliness, as Emma would say. I needed a gift for her. A bottle of Tobin wine was also not appropriate. I mean, what with them being ex-lovers and all. And she had access to all the local handicrafts and gift shop junk she'd ever need. Jeez, this one had me stumped. I hate to buy jewelry or clothes for women, but maybe that's what I had to do. Back on Main Road, I stopped at a service station and got gas. I also filled my windshield washer reservoir, washed my windshield, and invested in a local map. I took the opportunity to scope out the road to see if anyone was parked nearby watching me. It didn't appear that I was being followed, and I'm good at spotting a tail, the incident on West 102nd Street notwithstanding. I didn't think I was in any danger, yet I considered going home for my peace, then decided against it. Armed now with nothing more than a map and my superior intellect, I headed north, up to the bluffs. With some difficulty, I finally found the right dirt road that led to the right bluff. I parked, got out, and climbed to the top of the bluff. This time I poked around through the underbrush and the sawgrass. I found the rock I'd sat on and noted that it was big enough to be used as a point of reference if you were going to bury something. I went to the edge of the bluff. It was obvious that a good deal of erosion must have taken place over the last 300 years so that something buried on the north side, the sound side, of the bluff might well have been exposed by wind and water, and maybe tumbled down onto the beach. I was putting this together now. I came down from the bluff and got in my Jeep. Using my new map, I made my way to the west side of Mattituck Inlet. And there it was. No, not Captain Kidd's trees, but a sign that said Captain Kidd Estates. Apparently some subdivider had a marketing dream. I drove into Captain Kidd Estates, a small collection of 1960s ranches and Cape Cods. A kid, no pun intended, was riding by on his bicycle, and I stopped and asked him, "Do you know where Captain Kidd's trees are?" The boy, about 12, didn't reply. I said, "There's supposed to be a place near the inlet where there are a bunch of trees called Captain Kidd's trees." He looked at me, looked at my four-wheel drive, and I guess I struck him as an Indiana Jones type, because he asked me, "You gonna look for the treasure?" "Oh, no, I just want to take a picture of the trees." He buried his treasure chest under one of those trees. It seemed like everyone but me was hip to this. That's what happens when you don't pay attention. I said to the lad, "Where are the trees?" "My friends and me dug a big hole once before the cops chased us away. The trees are in a park, so you can't dig there. I just want to take a few pictures. If you want to dig, I'll watch for the cops." "Okay. Lead on." I followed the boy on his bike to a winding lane that led downhill to the sound and ended at a beach park where a few young mothers sat with toddlers in strollers. To the right was the Mattituck Inlet and a marina farther up the inlet. I pulled off to the side and got out. I didn't see any large oaks, only a field of brush and scrub trees across the lane. The field was bordered by the beach on the north and by the inlet on the east. Across the field, to the west, I could see a bluff descending to the water. On the south, from where I'd come, was a rise of land, which were the Captain Kidd Estates. The boy asked me, "Where's your shovel?" "I'm just taking pictures." "Where's your camera?" "What's your name?" "Billy." "What's yours?" "Johnny." "Is this the right place?" "Sure." "Where are Captain Kidd's trees?" "There. In the park." He pointed to the big field. It was apparently an undeveloped piece of parkland, part of the beach park, more a nature preserve than what my Manhattan mind thought of as a park. Still, I saw no towering oaks. I said to him, "I don't see the trees." "There." He pointed out to me all the scrub oak, wild cherry, and other assorted trees, none taller than 20 feet high. He said, "See that big one there? That's where me and Jerry dug. We're gonna go back some night."
"Good idea. Let's take a look."
Billy dropped his bike in the grass, and my new partner and I walked onto the field. The grass was high, but the bushes were widely spaced, and the walking was easy. Obviously, Billy hadn't paid attention in earth science class, or he'd have known that these few trees weren't 300 and 400 years old. In fact, I really hadn't expected to see 100-foot-high oaks with skulls and crossbones carved in them. Billy said, "Do you have a shovel in your car?" "No, I'm just scoping it out for now. Tomorrow we're coming back with bulldozers."
"Yeah?
If you find the treasure, you have to share." In my best pirate accent, I said, "If I find the treasure, me lad, I'll cut the throats of all who ask for their share." Billy grabbed his throat with two hands and made gurgling sounds. I kept walking, kicking at the sandy soil, until finally I found what I was looking for. A huge tree stump, half-rotted, covered with soil and vegetation. I said to Billy, "Did you ever see any more stumps like this?"
"Oh, yeah. They're like all over."
I looked around, picturing primeval oaks that once stood here in colonial times on this flat piece of land beside this big inlet in the sound. This was a natural haven for ships and men, and I could picture a three-master coming into the sound and anchoring offshore. A few men take a dinghy into the inlet and land about where my vehicle was parked on the lane. They moor the dinghy to a tree and wade ashore. They're carrying something. A chest, just as Tom and Judy carried a chest ashore. The seamen, William Kidd and a few others, enter the oak forest, pick a tree, dig a hole, bury the treasure, then somehow mark the tree and leave, intending to return someday. Of course, they never do. That's why there are so many legends of buried treasure. Billy said, "That's the tree where me and Jerry dug. Want to see?" "Sure." We walked over to a gnarled, wind-blown wild cherry, about 15 feet high. Billy pointed to the base of the tree where a shallow hole was half filled with sand. He said, "There." "Why not the other side of the tree? Why not a few feet away from the tree?" "I don't know. We guessed." "Hey, do you have a map? A treasure map?"
"I do. But if I show it to you, I have to make you walk the plank." He did a passable imitation of going off the end of Eternity's diving board. I started back toward the car, Buddy Billy at my side. I asked him, "How come you're not in school today?"
"Today is Rosh Hashanah."
"You Jewish?"
"No, but my friend Danny is."
"Where's Danny?"
"He went to school."
This kid had lawyer potential. We got back to my vehicle, and I found a fiver in my wallet. "Okay, Billy, thanks for your help." He took the bill and said, "Hey, thanks. You need more help?" "No, I have to go back and report to the White House."
"The White House?"
I picked up his bicycle and gave it to him. I got in my Jeep and started it up. I said to him, "That tree where you were digging isn't old enough to have been there in Captain Kidd's day."
"Yeah?"
"Captain Kidd was 300 years ago."
"Wow.
You know all those old rotten stumps in the ground? Those were big trees when Captain Kidd came ashore here. Try digging around one of those."
"Hey, thanks."
"If you find the treasure, I'll be back for my share."
"Okay.
But my friend Jerry might try to cut your throat." "I wouldn't, because you told us where the treasure is." "Jerry might cut your throat."
"Arrgh."
And off I went. Next stop, a gift for Emma. On my way, I put more of the mental puzzle together. Indeed, there may have been more than one treasure buried, but the one the Gordons were looking for, and may well have found, was buried on Plum Island. I was reasonably certain of that. And Plum Island was government land, and anything taken from the ground there belonged to the government, specifically the Department of the Interior. So the simple solution to cheating Caesar out of the treasure on Caesar's land is to move the treasure to your own land. If you rent, however, you have a problem. So voila, the 1 acre of waterfront purchased from Margaret Wiley. Some questions remained, however. One question was, how did the Gordons know there was possibly a hoard of treasure buried on Plum Island? Answer? They found out through their interest and membership in the Peconic Historical Society. Or someone else had figured out long ago that there was treasure on Plum Island, and that person or persons had no access to Plum Island. So he, she, or they befriended the Gordons, who, as senior staff, had almost unlimited access to the island. Eventually, this person or persons confided this knowledge to the Gordons, and a plot was hatched. A deal was made, signed in blood by the light of a flickering candle or something. Tom and Judy were good citizens, but they weren't saints. I thought of what Beth had said, "Saint seducing gold," and realized now how appropriate that was. The Gordons obviously intended to rebury the treasure on their land, then discover it and announce it to the world, and pay their honest taxes to Uncle and New York State. Maybe their partner had other ideas. That was it. The partner wasn't satisfied with his or her 50% of the loot on which presumably some heavy taxes had to be paid. This got me to wondering how much the treasure could be worth. obviously enough to commit double murder. A theory, as I teach in my class, has to fit all the facts. If it doesn't, you have to examine the facts. If the facts are correct and the theory doesn't work, then you have to alter the theory.
In this case, most of the early facts pointed to the wrong theory. That aside, I finally had what the physicists would call a unified theory. The Plum Island so-called archaeological digs, the high-priced powerboat, the expensive rental house on the water, the spirochete anchored off Plum Island, the membership in the Peconic Historical Society, and the 1 acre of apparently useless land on the Sound, and maybe the trip to England. Add to this the Gordon's whimsical flying of the Jolly Roger, the missing ice chest, and the 8-digit number on their sea chart, and you had a pretty solid unified theory that tied all these seemingly unconnected things together. Or, and this was the big or, I had lost too much blood from my brain, and I was totally wrong, completely off base, mentally unfit for detective duty, and lucky to be allowed to walk a beat in Staten Island. That, too, was possible. I mean, look at Foster and Nash, two reasonably smart guys with all the resources in the world behind them, and they were totally off base, chasing the wrong leads. They had good minds, yet they were confined by their narrow worldview. International intrigue, biological warfare, international terrorism, and all that. They probably never even heard of Captain Kidd. Good. Anyway, my unified theory notwithstanding, there were still things I didn't know and things I didn't understand. One thing I didn't know was who murdered Tom and Judy Gordon. Sometimes you catch the murderer even before you have all the facts or before you understand what you do have. In those cases, the murderer will sometimes be nice and explain to you what you missed, what you misunderstood, what his motives were, and so forth. When I get a confession, I want more than an admission of guilt. I want a lesson in the criminal mind. This is good for next time around, and there's always a next time around. In this case, I had what I thought was the motive, but not the murderer. All I knew about the murderer was that he or she was very clever. I couldn't imagine the Gordons plotting a crime with an idiot. One of the points in my mental map of this case was Tobin Vineyards. Even now, after I'd gotten hip to the kid thing and come up with my unified theory, I couldn't figure out how the relationship between Frederick Tobin and the Gordons fit into the whole picture. Well, maybe I could. I headed toward Tobin Vineyards.